I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jonathan Kay is a managing editor and columnist at the National Post. He has written a fascinating and highly readable book, Among the Truthers. Its subtitle says it all, A Journey into the Growing Conspiracist Underground of 9/11 Truthers, Birthers, Armageddonites, Vaccine Hysterics, Hollywood Know-Nothings, and Internet Addicts. Mr. Kay researches and interviews those in the world of conspiracy theories. He examines their beliefs and thoughts, how they got to what they believe, and what it means to our society, our discourse, and our politics. The book is published by HarperCollins. The website for more is at AmongTheTruthers.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jonathan Kay. Good morning, Mr. Kay.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what this book is not is debunking conspiracy theories, right?
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because if people want to debunk conspiracy theories, they have numerous resources available to them on the web. In the case of 9/11 conspiracy theories, for instance, Popular Mechanics published a book in 2005 that serves that purpose well. And also, I just don't think there's that much use in that kind of book. People who believe in these theories aren't interested in reading that kind of book, and people who don't believe these conspiracy theories have no use for that kind of book. So I wanted to write a different kind of book.
So we're at a point in history where conspiracy theories seem to be at their most ubiquitous. Why is that?
There's a couple of reasons. Historically, conspiracy theories have always flourished in the shadow of great historical traumas, wars and depressions and the like. And in the United States in particular, the last decade has been pretty bad. There's been 9/11, of course. There has been the war in Afghanistan, which is still completely unresolved. There was the war in Iraq, which in the last year or two has gone better, but took thousands of Americans' lives. And perhaps most important of all, especially for birthers, has been the financial recession, the financial crisis that began in 2008 and has really carried forward and still to this day affects the American economy and has taken millions of jobs. And in periods like that, people look for something to blame. The forces that cause these sort of things are typically very complicated. The financial crisis has a lot of complicated causes. And people generally like to focus on simple villains that they can identify. And this goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. The most notorious example, of course, is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, when Europe began to blame its problems on Jews in the first part of the 20th century. And I don't think modern conspiracy theories are anywhere near as poisonous as that. They're certainly not as hateful. But the basic structure of the conspiracy theories are more or less the same.
Now, just talking about recent conspiracy theories, especially in the last 10 years or so, in the book you talk about it's mainly an American phenomenon, I guess, right? I mean,
as a Canadian, I was proud sense that to the extent that Canadians are interested in conspiracy theories, they tend to be American-themed conspiracy theories.
Yeah, is that because we don't have our own, or are we more rational or more believing, say, of government?
I think it has to do with political and religious structure, because the politics of the United States, if you go back to the 18th century, America is a country born in revolution against a foreign government. And from that time onward, American politicians and American activists and grassroots American political groups have always been obsessed with the idea of a foreign entity coming to control the United States, whether in the form of communism or in the form of Catholicism or the Freemasons or the Illuminati, or more recently it's the Islamists. You had New World Order conspiracy theorists in the 80s and 90s. And this is a dominant theme of American political life. You had the populist movement in the late 19th century, which focused on international banking cartels coming to take over the United States. And a lot of this is just based on the political DNA of the United States because of the way the United States was created more than 200 years ago. So that's one factor, which you obviously don't have in Canada. The second factor is religiosity. The United States has a lot of evangelical Christians, and part of the structure of evangelical Christian narrative is taken from the book of Revelation and is the cosmic struggle between good and evil. And the idea that this cosmic struggle is building up to some kind of apocalyptic climax. And when I interviewed a lot of the religious conspiracy theorists, you saw a lot of influence of this theory. They would look to the United Nations or to world events and try to determine where the secular devil figures were marshaling their forces. And again, this is just something we have a little bit of in Canada, but the influence of evangelical Christianity is not to the same extent here.
Now, talking about the people themselves that you talk about in the book, we're not supposed to take these people as a whole group because they believe in different things, of course. But can you assign some state diagnosis, I guess, of their state of mind? I mean, for the most part, they're men, right?
Yes. Most conspiracy theorists are men. And this is something I immediately noticed when I would go to these conspiracy theory conventions, 9/11 truth conventions, or the radical fringes of the Tea Party movement in the United States. And you'd see mostly men, and some of the women who were there looked like they had been sort of dragged there by their boyfriends. And part of it is just many conspiracy theories are extremely detailed. And the people who really get into them will sometimes spend 16 or 18 hours a day in front of a computer and will become completely antisocial and will spend all their time watching YouTube videos or performing calculations of how the World Trade Center fell. They'll get extremely interested in science fiction debates about what kind of weapons were used to bring down the World Trade Center, for instance, or what kind of technology was used to alter Barack Obama's birth certificate. They almost regress into a sort of adolescent world of Buck Rogers ray guns and that sort of thing, and it has very, very limited appeal for women. In terms of personality types, I went into the project thinking that there would be a universal personality type for conspiracy theorists. What I found was that the people I interviewed tended to cluster around different kinds of personality types, sort of a identifiable typology. For instance, younger conspiracy theorists tended to be sort of campus firebrand types, campus revolutionaries, if you will, the sort of people who maybe 20 or 30 years ago would have become Marxists or anarchists and held big noisy demonstrations, but since those ideologies don't hold much currency now, instead they've channeled their political rage into conspiracy theories, and instead they go around downtown with placards that say, tell us the truth about 911 and stuff. And then some of the older conspiracy theorists I interviewed were men who were going through what was essentially a midlife crisis, and they had lost trust in everything in life, public and private, public institutions and private relationships. And the conspiracy theory became a sort of way to express their nihilistic distrust in the society around them. Some of the people I interviewed were genuinely mentally unstable, although that was a very small subset of the people I interviewed. Some of the other people were radicalized nationalists who were using conspiracy theories to recast history according to their chosen ideological script. So you had Islamists or radical Zionists or the like. Birthers also fall into that category just simply because they are essentially trying to rewrite the 2008 presidential election. This is for people who come to conspiracy theories from a political motivation. A lot of it has to do with trying to correct the course of history as they see it. Because they think history has taken some illegitimate turn, and they're trying to identify who it was who caused history to go off course.
It's someone like Trump, I guess, right?
Well, Trump is sort of a unique specimen because I don't think he actually ever believed the birther conspiracy theory. I don't see him as a true conspiracy theorist. I think for him it was about marketing. I think he saw that there were millions of Republicans who believed that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States, and most of the mainstream Republican presidential candidates or potential candidates were staying away from that issue because it's so ridiculous. And as a sort of clever marketing campaign, he decided he was going to be the one to sink to that level and exploit it. But I don't think he himself believed it. I think it was just a marketing gimmick.
Yeah, and he's announced this morning that he's not running. It's a big surprise that Donald Trump is an opportunist, I guess.
Yeah.
So in the beginning of the book, you write that before starting the book, when you'd read these emails that they'd send you, these people would send you, or read some of the literature that's online or elsewhere, that you could tell that you were dealing with damaged minds. Has there been much psychological research into the phenomenon of conspiracy theories?
Very little. In fact, one of the only studies I saw of conspiracy theorists, they tried to see what factors in their life conspiracism correlated to, you know, all the usual factors like race and income and stuff like that. And the only thing that belief in one conspiracy theory correlates to tends to be belief in other conspiracy theories, which is to say that conspiracism becomes a kind of creed, and people who believe, for instance, elaborate JFK conspiracy theories tend to be exactly the same kind of people who will then embrace 9/11 truth conspiracy theories, or will tell you that the pharmaceutical companies are trying to poison us. But aside from that, it's very, very difficult to predict who's going to become a conspiracy theorist or not. In terms of that comment about damaged minds, you know, there are some people out there who really have lost their sanity to this issue. And I was on National Public Radio recently, and after my appearance, I got this very sad email from a woman who said that her husband had been a respected doctor in their community, and now he just spent all his time in the basement pursuing these conspiracy theories and had become completely antisocial. And from what she was describing, it didn't sound like he was clinically insane. It just sounded like he had driven himself to complete monomaniacal distraction with this intellectual pursuit. So, yes, these are damaged people, but to a certain extent, it's a political and social phenomenon. In most cases, it's not a medical phenomenon.
So to those of us who aren't conspiracy theorists, are we people that don't think, or are we not curious, or do we just accept everything at face value without question?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the conspiracy theorists I interviewed, almost all of them, describe themselves as being extremely skeptical and extremely rational, and they tend to describe other people around them who don't subscribe to their theories as being sort of sheep who just blindly listen to what authority figures tell them. And so they cast themselves in heroic terms, you know, suggesting that that they are people who have more intellectual courage than people around them. And there's some grain of truth to that, in the sense that, yes, they do have the courage to reject all known sources of authority, and they put aside trust, they put aside their social relationships in many cases, they put aside political correctness, and they embrace views that a lot of us find weird. To me, that isn't a sign of intellectual courage, it's a sign of intellectual nihilism, because ultimately, you do need to have some trust in some authority figures in society. Otherwise, you're just going to go around questioning every single thing that you're told, including very basic things like the idea that the world is round. Which, you know, I couldn't prove that the world is round, but I do trust scientists who tell me that the world is round. And that's why it's so frustrating having an argument with a conspiracy theorist, because let's say, for instance, I'm trying to establish the fact that the World Trade Center buildings fell because airplanes hit them, and I will cite the 2007 NIST report on, take for example, World Trade Center Building 7, and I'll say this detailed study was done by NIST into the engineering causes of the collapse of this building, and these are the conclusions they came to. But of course, the people I talked to put no trust in that, because that was a study commissioned by the government. Anything to do with the government must be corrupt. And so instead of that, they just watch YouTube videos, and they trust their own reaction to YouTube videos or their own esoteric layman's research on the Internet more than they trust authoritative government reports. Now, they would say, well, that's because they're more skeptical and they're more intellectually courageous. And I guess, you know, if you want to cast it that way, you could, but it's an intellectually impossible existence to go around questioning every single thing you're told, because then you're going to believe nothing, and you're not going to be able to have any kind of intellectual engagement with the people around you who do trust things like peer-reviewed scientific journals or government reports or the like, which is the basis for almost all mainstream intellectual inquiry in our society.
Have people come up to you saying that this book is nonsense, that you're simply covering up for the establishment, whatever the establishment is, that you're just carrying their water because you're a member of the media?
Yeah, I mean, I say that in the book.
Because
the basic function of any conspiracy theory is that when presented with contrary evidence, you just expand the circle of alleged conspirators. Like, that's the basic way a conspiracy theory operates. And so you expand the circle and you say, well, it includes the government and includes the banking system and includes this and includes that. And when you say, well, what about the media? They say, well, of course the media is involved because the media is owned by corporations. And so, you know, look at me. I write for the National Post newspaper. I write for HarperCollins, book publisher. I am completely untrustworthy from the point of a conspiracy theorist. They just assume that I have been told what to say by the powers that be. And so I didn't write this book for conspiracy theorists because, of course, they don't trust me. I wrote this book for people who aren't conspiracy theorists because in this field, I think an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Now, the media has also been used as a sort of, I guess, has been blamed for a lot of this by both the left and the right, and I guess the Internet has changed not only conspiracy theories but the media as well. Has that always, I mean, that's, I guess, a recent phenomenon, hasn't it? Just how the media has been just sort of thought of as the enemy as well as, you know.
Well, what's happened is in the last 4 or 5 decades, studies have consistently shown a rapid decline in trust in all public institutions. That includes the government. That includes religious figures. And it also includes the media. You know, 40 or 50 years ago, people tuned into one of the 3 major network broadcasts in the United States for dinner time news, and the people on those shows were extremely trusted figures. Now, that's not the case. The media, there's very little trust in the media, in part because every time you tune on, you tune in MSNBC or Fox News or Sun News, or, you know, there's all sorts of people telling you not to trust the other guy because it's become talking heads screaming at each other. And there's so many news options that people just find a news source that's tailored to their own ideology, and they assume everybody else is lying. So times have changed, and the structure of the news has changed, and as a result, the trust has gone down. But it's not just the Internet and the structure of the news. It's also, as I say, every single public institution in society has suffered a decline in trust in the last 40 or 50 years.
There's a great quote in the book, and I wish I wrote it down or wrote who said it. It's about it came from the Eisenhower administration era, and it had to do with I guess consumption of media and whether we trust media. And you said, you know, that this could have been written now about Glenn Beck and about cable news.
Oh yeah, I think that was Hofstadter.
Hofstadter, exactly. Yeah. What has, in arguing with conspiracy theories, have they, in the course of writing this book, have they changed your mind at all about certain things? Like, I mean, 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination or the moon landing, say?
No. The only thing they forced me to do is sort of re-examine my own thinking more generally in the way I arrive at my own ideological conclusions on things. Because what's happened is, interviewing them, I've seen that these are people who, for emotional reasons, have decided what they think, and then they spend the rest of their lives looking for proof of what they think. And then they then retroactively describe that as free-minded intellectual inquiry. It's not free-minded intellectual inquiry. They seize on a conclusion for an emotional reason, and then they dive down the rabbit hole looking for evidence. From observing that, it's made me more careful about my ideological commitments. And sometimes I catch myself following that pattern. I mean, not to the same pathological extent, I like to think, but I think all of us are guilty, not just conspiracy theorists, all of us are guilty of pursuing evidence to bolster preconceived notions, preferring news sources that indicate a point of view that agrees with our own point of view, shunning news sources that might challenge our ideology. And so these are patterns in everybody's thoughts that I've become more aware of from writing this book, because the book has put me into contact with people whose exhibition of these tendencies is pathological. I wouldn't put myself in that category, but I think as a cautionary tale, you can learn from these people what happens to the human mind if you do get overly committed to one point of view.
Now, there's a great sweep of history that you do in this book, going, you know, hundreds of years back and seeing the different conspiracy theories over the years. You talk in the book about them recurring throughout our history, sort of the popularity of them. As I mentioned off the top, we're at a high point. How does this recede, do you think, or does it?
Well, part of the answer is I don't know, because this is the first time in human history these media technologies have existed. One of the big reasons, I think, we're at such an uptick in conspiracy theories is that we've never before had these technologies available to radicals to circulate the ideas. These technologies are too young for me to make predictions about it. They've only been around for about 15 years in the case of the World Wide Web. And, 50 years ago, it was very difficult for a conspiracy theorist to circulate his point of view. He'd have to write a book or, somehow find a way to get on community access television or whatnot. These days, the conspiracy theorists I talk to, many of them have hundreds of thousands of fans, despite never publishing a book and just operating a blog or creating a YouTube video. And this is unprecedented. Never before have so many fringe thinkers been able to challenge conventional wisdom with no money, with no education, with no media credibility, and all they need is access to an internet account, and that's it. They're off to the races. And I can't make predictions about how this kind of intellectual marketplace is going to play out, because it literally is completely unprecedented in human history. And people have made a big deal about how the internet has revolutionized social media and it's revolutionized journalism, but it's also revolutionized fringe politics and conspiracy theories. And I can't make any confident prediction about how that's going to play out. But it's a challenge to people in the mainstream media like myself, because as we noted earlier, our authority is being challenged by people running websites.
Now, how do we rationalize, thinking so that we don't devolve into anarchy?
Part of it has to do with education. In the last chapter of my book, I talk about how I think conspiracism is a pattern of thinking that should be recognized as such. You know, the last couple of decades, we've become very good at recognizing, well, oh, that's racist, or that's sexist, that's intolerant, that's a stereotype. I'd like to think that in my book I made the case that conspiracism is just as pernicious, it is just as identifiable a pattern of thought, it's just as challenging to civil discourse, and I think recognizing that kind of thought should be part of our education system, in the same way that we teach kids to recognize other negative styles of thinking.
And when you talk about websites, I hope you're not lumping this one in part of the conspiracy theorist websites or the sort.
The sort of websites I'm talking about, you know, I think your listeners would identify very quickly.
Right.
It's the kind where you have, you know, you see a big picture of Barack Obama with a line through it that says illegal alien, or the equivalent picture of the World Trade Center towers falling with a picture of George Bush saying wanted for murder. I've gotten pretty good at identifying very quickly which sites are fringe and which sites are mainstream.
Yeah, and when you talked about anybody signing up for it and getting online, getting an audience, I mean, that's what I did, so I just...
Oh, no, I mean, these technologies have been used for all kinds of positive purposes, including this one. Look, I blog, too, on the National Post website. I use Facebook. I use all these technologies myself. The problem, of course, is that there's no barrier to entry. So, I mean, the blessing and the problem is that there's no barrier to entry. So anyone can jump on. And, some of the people I interviewed have a very disturbing way of looking at the world. But the people who go to their websites haven't met them. So all they see is a professional-looking website. And they start reading the articles. They start surfing the video. And before you know it, they get sucked in, not knowing how disreputable the people who run it are, in some cases.
Jonathan, I've enjoyed this book and the conversation this morning. It's a fascinating one. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The website for more can be found at AmongTheTruthers.com. The book is called Among the Truthers, A Journey into the Growing Conspiracist Underground of 9/11 Truthers, Birthers, Armageddonites, Vaccine Hysterics, Hollywood Know-Nothings, and Internet Addicts. It's published by HarperCollins, the National Post's Jonathan Kay on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.